This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillah. Before we get into this week's topic, very brief recap of last week's topic, because alhamdulillah, seeing a lot of faces here who weren't here last week. And as last week's topic was very technical, you'll be a bit lost if you didn't. So, how many people didn't attend last week? Just raise your hands. Okay. Did any of you listen to the recording of last week's? If you raise your hands, if you listen to the recording, no. Okay. So I'll have to go through it again. But for those of you who want the recordings, the audio recordings of the series are available on MuslimCentral.com, also on my iTunes channel and my Google Podcast channel. And hopefully from this session we'll have it up on YouTube as well, if you can get the video right. Okay. Otherwise, Muslim Central, everything's available there. So last week we spoke about Usulul Fiqh, an introduction to the topic. Can someone tell me briefly in one sentence what is Usulul Fiqh? Let's see who remembers. In one sentence, what is Usulul Fiqh? Principles of what?
Understanding of the principles.
Yeah. It's the principles that the ulama use for working out fiqh rulings. Right? Usulul fiqh simply means the methodology and principles of ulama to work out fiqh. Fiqh isn't just something where someone looks at the hadith and comes up with an idea, or someone makes something off the top of their head. There's a methodology to it. And that's what we are studying over these 6 weeks. We are studying the methodology of how to derive fiqh. Very important point I mentioned last week, I have to repeat it for those who are new. By the end of the 6 weeks, you will not be able to make your own fiqh rulings. This is a crash course, this is a introduction, right? You literally need years of study before you get to that level, as you will see now with the history of fiqh. So last week, we went through the basic terminology. Fiqh means a human understanding of Islamic law. Sharia is Islamic law. Fiqh is a human understanding of Islamic law. Usulul fiqh is how a person derives the understanding of Islamic law. And we said that generally there's 5 categories of fiqh. When a scholar is doing fiqh, what they're doing is they're trying to put something into one of 5 categories. That's what fiqh is. Someone brings something to you to say, is this halal or haram? Right? That's basically what they're asking you. So you have one of 5 answers. Right? It's either wajib, it's compulsory, it's mustahab, it's recommended, it's halal, it's makruh, it's disliked, or it's haram. And by the way, the first 4 categories together all actually are halal, including makruh. Right? Makruh is a subcategory of halal. Right? So that's the other main terms we spoke about. The other terms that we discussed, inshallah, we'll come to them over the next few weeks in more detail. But we went through the basic usulul fiqh in terms of the definition, Quran, Sunnah, consensus of the scholars, which is called ijma in the Arabic language, qiyas, which is the logical deduction from a scholar, and urf, local culture. Right? And we're going to do a lecture on each of these. So next week we will discuss Quran and Sunnah and how they play a role in fiqh. The week after that we will look at the consensus and qiyas, logical deduction, and how they play a role in fiqh. And in the 5th week we will look at urf. Urf is the local culture, and how local culture is an important principle of fiqh, particularly in the Hanafi madhab. So this week we're taking a break from the technical stuff to look at the history, right? And normally when I teach the history of fiqh, I spend 5 months teaching it. Today I'm going to attempt something completely different, which is doing the entire 5 months in 1 hour, right? So just a disclaimer, I'm going to make a lot of broad sweeping statements about entire centuries. Because you cannot discuss 1,400 years of history in 1 hour without making broad statements. So I may say for 400 years the ulama did this. And you say, but I know a certain alim who lived in that era who never do it. Yes, that's true. But we don't have time to go into all the details. So we're going to take this in a very broad manner. Now why do we need to know the history? Because number one, most Muslims don't know what a madhab is, or where it came from, or how it came about, and so we are confused about it. As soon as you study the history, it all makes sense. It all makes sense. Right? Number two, people don't understand why are there differences of opinion. Every day, I get this question from young people. Why can't we all just have one madhab? Why can't we all just have the same opinion? When you study the history, you understand why. It's just not humanly possible. Right? It's just not humanly possible for everybody to have the same conclusion on every issue. That's just not the way Allah made us. Right? So the history will clarify these things and also clarify the importance of the usul. So I'm going to break this down very quickly into about 5 or 6 errors. Right? Yeah, 6 errors. Generally, the book I use breaks it down into 4 errors. Revelation, development, flowering, and stagnation. I'm adding 2 more from my side, because just to make it a bit more nuanced, we break it down into 6 errors. We're going to start off revelation, the prophet's time, what happened with fiqh then. Development, the first 100 years of our history, the Khulafa Rashidin and the Umayyad time, what happened with fiqh then. The flowering phase, the early Abbasid era. The expansion phase, the late Abbasid era. The stagnation and decline phase, the late Abbasid era and the Ottoman era. And then finally, the modern era, which is the attempts at revival. So this sounds confusing right now, but once we go through the history, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Basically, anything in history goes through ups and downs, right? Anything that rises, it goes down, and then it goes up again. So the same thing happened with fiqh. Fiqh went up, it reached a peak, it started going down, and now we're trying to take it back up again. And that's what you're going to see through this history. So again, we're doing this very quickly. It's literally 5 months of teachings condensed into 1 hour. So I'm going to very quickly go through the revelation and development phase. I'm going to spend most of the time on the flowering phase, because that's the most important. That's when the mazhabs actually came about. So we're going to spend the majority of the lecture on the flowering phase. But the first 2 phases, we will go through them very quickly. Number 1, obviously, we go back to the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. In the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, fiqh wasn't needed much. Who can tell me why? Why was fiqh not needed in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? He was there, right? 2 people are fighting over whether their pants should be above their ankle or not. What do they do? Go and ask him, right? Now, after he passes away, gets more complicated. One person is bringing one narration. Someone saying, "No, I heard him say something else." Someone else saying, "No, he didn't mean that. He meant this." Now the difference has come about, right? But while he's alive, not much difference of opinion. Why? Because he's there. Ask him, he'll clarify, right? So 2 main things happen in this period. Over 23 years, the Quran is revealed, and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam explains it and presents the details of it. That is called the Sunnah, and the Sunnah is recorded in the Hadiths, right? Hadith means a narration. A narration in which we get information about the Sunnah. So the Quran is revealed and the Prophet ﷺ explains the Quran. So the Quran tells us to pray. The Prophet ﷺ showed us how to pray, when to pray, how many rakats, what are the movements, what to say. That is all found where? In the Hadith. The reality is the majority of fiqh comes from Hadith, not Quran. Majority of fiqh comes from Hadith, because the Prophet ﷺ explained the details of it. Right? During the time of the Prophet ﷺ, we do see examples of ijtihad. And again, for those who are new, who weren't here last week, ijtihad simply means a scholar trying to figure out the correct ruling. So we see this primarily with Abu Bakr, with Umar, also with a few of the others, like some of the scholars who the Prophet ﷺ sent to distant lands to do da'wah, like Mus'ab ibn Umair when he sent him to Medina, and the scholars he sent to Yemen and to other parts of the world. We do see examples of ijtihad. For example, when the Prophet ﷺ got the prisoners of the Battle of Badr, right? He asked Abu Bakr and Umar, what should we do with the prisoners? So Abu Bakr gave one opinion, Umar gave the complete opposite opinion. The Prophet ﷺ followed Abu Bakr's opinion, and then the Quran revealed that Umar was right on this issue. So already we see Abu Bakr and Umar, the Prophet ﷺ is doing what? He's training them in ijtihad. Another example, right? One of the scholars from amongst the Sahaba, the Prophet ﷺ sends him to Yemen. So before he goes, the Prophet ﷺ gives him advice. He tells him, if people ask you questions, what are you going to do? He says, I'll check in the Quran. So the Prophet ﷺ asks him, if you don't find in the Quran, he says, I'll refer back to what you taught me, meaning Hadith. He said, what if you don't find it in the Quran or Hadith? Then the scholar said, I will use my mind. The Prophet ﷺ said, that's the right way, right? So here we see the first examples of what? Qiyas, right? Where the Prophet ﷺ is approving that a scholar, when he moves to a new land and deals with new issues, he's going to deal with qiyas. So 4 things happened in this time. Quran was revealed, the Sunnah was developed. We see 2 schools of interpretation evolving. What do I mean by this? I gave the example last week. One group of Sahaba took whatever the Prophet ﷺ said literally. The other group of Sahaba, they looked at what does he mean? What is the context, right? So we see, for example, Abdullah ibn Umar, radiallahu anhu, he followed the sunnah very literally. Right? He was extremely literal. If the Prophet said it, that's it. We follow it. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, radiallahu anhu, he would look at, okay, what did he mean? You know, what was the context? When did he say it? Why did he say it? Who was he saying it to? Was it just for that person or was it for all of us? You know, he looked at it from a different perspective. So we see two madhabs developing. One madhab, and they get the names in the next era, the people of Roy, the people of opinion. The other madhab, the people of hadith. Right? Ahlul Roy, Ahlul Hadith. And number four, we see examples of Sahaba starting to make ijtihad. Okay, so we go to that. That's very quick. Not much happens then that's related to our topic of fiqh because the Sharia was still being revealed. Okay, next period. The first century of our history, which is the time of the Khulafa Rashidin and the early Umayyads. Now, the history of Islamic writing begins when? Does anyone know in which century do we actually get Islamic books? In the second century. Right? We don't actually have books dating back to the first century. Does anybody know why? Why don't we have hadith books or fiqh books written like 50 years after the Prophet ﷺ passed away or 60 years after he passed away? Anyone knows why? Paper, yes. Paper, until that point in history, was a Chinese secret. Around the turn of the century, the Muslims learned that secret from the Chinese, and so they began to produce books. So it's only at the turn of the century we see the first books being produced. So in the first century of Islam, there are no books, there are no madhabs. Right? Rather, fiqh is a very practical thing. What happens? People go to the local alim. That's as simple as what fiqh is in the first century. Right? You're living in Kufa, you go to the masjid, you see one sheikh sitting in the masjid, you go ask him your questions. You're living in Damascus, you see someone sitting in the masjid, one sheikh, you go and ask him your questions. It's a very practical thing. There's no mazhab, there's no books, there's no schools of thought. It's just one old man sitting in the masjid, or could be young too, and you walk up to him and you ask him your questions. Right? So, every generation in this 100 years had their ulama. In the first generation, we have Abdullah ibn Abbas, Aisha binti Abi Bakr, Abu Huraira, Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, Abdullah ibn Umar ibn al-Khattab. We have all of these ulama in the first generation. Second generation, we have Hassan al-Basri, we have Aisha binti Talha, we have Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, we have many, many scholars. Now, the third generation is when fiqh really develops. So we'll come to that in the next phase. So in this phase, there's two different trends developing in two different parts of the Muslim world. In the Hijaz, anyone know what's the Hijaz? Makkah and Medina and the surrounding areas, right? They were called the Hijaz until the current kingdom took over and slapped their family name on it, right? But before that, it was the Hijaz, right? So the Hijaz, Makkah and Medina and the surrounding areas, and in Syria, the ulama are moving more towards a Ahlul Hadith approach. Meaning, the ulama in those areas preferred to just follow what the Hadith says. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the ulama of that area, like Ibrahim al-Nakhai, and from the Sahaba Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, they are moving more towards the Ahlul Ra'i approach, which is using their opinion. Why? Two reasons. Number one, there's more Hadiths available in the Hijaz in Syria. There's less Hadith available in Iraq. Number two, in Iraq, there are a lot of Shia and other Khawarij and other groups, and they are the ones narrating the hadith. So the ulama growing up in that area and studying in that area, they're more skeptical about whether the hadiths in the area are authentic or not. So they relied less on hadith than the ulama in the Hijaz and Syria. So now we have two, you can see two mazhabs developing, right? One part of the world, they're taking a more rational approach. The other part of the world, they're taking a more textual approach. Now we come to the main part of our history. And the bulk of today's presentation, we'll slow down now, the bulk of today's presentation on this part of our history. The early Abbasid era, late Umayyad era, which is the second and third century of our history. This is the main part of our history. For those of you who don't know, the second and third century of Islamic history was the golden age of fiqh, the golden age of hadith, the golden age of science, the golden age of technology, the golden age of culture, of language, of philosophy, of everything in the Muslim world. At this point in time, we have the Umayyads ruling over Spain, and Spain becomes the most dominant civilization in Europe. And the Abbasids ruling over the rest of the Muslim world, and it becomes really the main civilization in the world, the global superpower. Right? So this is the golden age. And so in the golden age of Islam, This is when the madhabs develop. This is when the books of fiqh are written. This is when the books of hadith are written. This is when really scholarship blossoms. That's why we call it the flowering phase. It blossoms. Whatever was growing in the first 100 years, now we see the fruit of it in this period. So, what we see happening in the Abbasid era is that many scholars are now starting to write and to develop their usul, their methodologies. And these scholars, they're developing a following. So like nowadays, a lot of people have this problem with the idea of celebrity scholars. Right? They say, hey, so many people are following that Mufti or that Mulana, it's got too many fans. Naturally, in every era, there are ulama that have more fans than others. Right? So you can say Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Malik, they were the celebrity scholars of this era. Meaning, there'd be one sheikh sitting in a masjid teaching, he'll have 10 or 20 students. Imam Abu Hanifa comes to the masjid, 10,000 people come for his lecture. Right? So they are like the celebrity scholars of this era. Why? Their intellect, the depth of their knowledge, their piety, right? The ability to deal with the problems of their time. All of this put together, this makes them people who people flock towards, people want to follow. So, during this time, we see the first fiqh and usulul fiqh books written. Right? The first fiqh book, the oldest fiqh book that we have, is the Muwatta of Imam Malik. Imam Malik, third generation Muslim, right? He writes the Muwatta. Now, many of us know the Muwatta as a book of hadith, right? Reality is, it's a book of fiqh which contains hadith. If you look at the system that the Muwatta is written in, the chapter headings, the explanations, the quotations from other ulama, it's a book of fiqh. But it relies primarily on hadith. So it's both hadith and fiqh, right? He was in Medina. Yes. He was in Medina, and that's a land where there's a lot of hadith. So naturally, his fiqh contains a lot of hadith. Around the same time, his student, Imam Ash-Shafi'i, right? So Imam Ash-Shafi'i is Imam Malik's student. He writes the first Usulul Fiqh book, Ar-Risala. And this book is so brilliant. I read this book recently. And what really struck me about this book was the methodology in which he wrote it. Imam Ash-Shafi'i wrote this book as a conversation between him and an imaginary opponent. Right? So he wrote this book in the form of a fictional conversation. Someone's asking him questions and he's answering the question. Somebody's refuting his point and he's refuting their point. But the entire thing is like a fictional conversation which teaches you all of Imam Ash-Shafi'i's Usul al-Fiqh. So it's very fascinating that the first ever book on Usul al-Fiqh was written in such a creative manner. It wasn't written as a dry fiqh manual like how we have nowadays. He was very, very creative in his style. Now there is something that happened in this time that made all of this take place. A few developments, but just to name a few. Number one, we said paper became available, right? So paper is available, they can start writing. Number two, the ulama, the governors of this time and the kings of this time, they supported scholarship, right? So we start around 93 years after the Prophet ﷺ passed away. King Walid the First, he establishes a new policy, which is the ulama are paid a salary by the government. Right? His brother-in-law Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, when he becomes the Khalifa, he increases the salary of ulama. So now, we're going about 50 years after that, people becoming ulama, they are guaranteed a good salary, a good life. Not like nowadays. Right? So in that period, golden age, if you becoming an alim in the golden age, you are guaranteed a good life for the rest of your life. If you look at Imam Malik, he took a salary from the government. He wore the best of clothes, wore the best of perfumes, lived the best of lives. Right? They were guaranteed a salary and a good salary. You could live a nice life. So, if you are an alim living in that time, you have money. You're not starving. You're not compromising your principles. You're not worried about how I'm going to support my family. Right? You have access to books. You have access to other ulama. You have access to information. You have all of these new ideas. So at this time, for example, Muslims started studying Greek philosophy books. So from there, they get the idea of dividing things into topics and dividing those topics into subheadings. So now we have fiqh, usulul fiqh, hadith, tafsir. From there, each of these are broken up into different fields and those are broken up further. Right? So they are taking knowledge from different nations and they are developing around that. So all of this caused the rise of the different madhabs. So during this period, between 10 to 15 madhabs become popular. Right? There are between 10 to 15 ulama who gain a large following. And these become the major madhabs of the time. So if we live during the golden age of Islam, there were not four madhabs as many people think. Right? This is a myth that there's always been four madhabs. Rather, in the golden age, They were anywhere between 10 to 15. It's hard to really say because each person had a different level of following. So you can't, sometimes it's hard to say, what, can we really consider this scholar as a madhab or just one guy with 10 students? You know, it's a bit difficult to say what we categorize as madhabs at this point in time. But just to go through some of the ulama of this period and the madhabs they developed. Number one, of course, Abu Hanifa. He was from the second generation, the Tabi'in. And living in Iraq, he took the Ahlul Rai approach. Right? So this means, because he lived in an area where the majority of people who were narrating hadith were not very, they weren't very authentic narrators. There's a bit of doubt about whether it's authentic or not. He took a very strict approach towards accepting hadith in fiqh. So he would not accept a hadith in fiqh unless it's reached like the highest levels of authenticity. And I can't go into the details of that now because we have to do an usul al-hadith class to understand that. But suffice to say, you'll find in the Hanafi madhab more rulings based on qiyas and on culture than in the other madhabs because he had this approach. In Medina, Imam Malik develops his madhab. Very unique approach. The unique approach of Imam Malik is, anything the people of Medina do is the sunnah. This is his approach. So if the people of Medina are doing something, and the one hadith from one scholar says the opposite, he goes with what the people of Medina are doing. What do you think is the rationale behind this? These are the grandchildren of the Sahaba. Literally the people of Medina at the time were who? The grandchildren of the Sahaba. Where did they learn it from? Their parents, who learned it from their parents, who learned it from the Prophet ﷺ. So in the Maliki Madhab, we have a principle of fiqh called the practice of the people of Medina, which is considered a sunnah passed down through deeds, not through words. So that is, he gave preference to that over hadith. Right? So now we see now different approaches. Imam Ash-Shafi, he studies under Imam Malik. He's the next generation now. He studies under Imam Malik. He studies under Imam Abu Hanifa's students. And he develops his own approach. This is the pure Ahlul Hadith approach. Quran, Sunnah, then Ijma, then Qiyas. And just these four things. Right? So this is the Ahlul Hadith approach of Ash-Shafi. His student, Ahmad ibn Hanbal, takes the Ahlul Hadith approach even further. He says, even if the Hadith is weak, we'll still use it in fiqh. Right? He is so strict on following Hadith, he says, even if the Hadith is weak, we'll follow it in fiqh. So now, you can see why there's difference of opinion between these four ulama, because their approaches to fiqh, very different. Now, here's the thing, none of these approaches are wrong. It's just a matter of people developing the ideas. Okay, so he was in Iraq as well. Right? Yeah, most of them. Only Imam Malik. Imam Malik is from Medina. Imam Shafi, he traveled a lot. Right? So he was in Medina, then he was in Egypt, then he was in Iraq. He was all over the place. He was a traveler. Right? More madhabs.
Was one of the teachers of Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq?
Yes, Jafar al-Sadiq.
He was a Shia Imam.
He wasn't Shia in the sense that we understand today. He was Shia politically.
Pardon?
He was, yeah, the Shias considered him the Imam.
Yeah.
But at the time when he was alive, Shiism wasn't the theology it is today. It was more a political movement. Yeah, it was a political movement at that time. And I'm actually going to mention one of the Shia madhabs now as well. I'm not talking about the Jafri one, but I'm going to talk about another one that came up during this time. Right? But pretty simply, Jafar al-Sadiq was a scholar of Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. He was a descendant of the Prophet ﷺ. He was Shia in politics. What do you mean by Shia in politics? We mean at that time, some people felt the Umayyads deserved the Khilafat. Other people said, no, the Prophet's family deserved the Khilafat. So this is political. It's nothing to do with what we believe about the individual, or what we believe about people having certain divine right. This is a matter of politics.
So the Shia theology hadn't developed by then?
Not by then, no. This came centuries later.
After that.
Yes, this came after that. Right.
So who gave the foundation of the Shia theology?
Well, we'll come to that later. Okay. Okay. Before I move any further, let's save the questions for the end. Okay? Because it disturbs my chain of thought. So, again, if you have questions, write it down. At the end, we have half an hour just for Q&A, inshallah. Okay, the next madhab. Now, the next two madhabs go in complete opposite directions. I call this, and I don't mean it in a bad way, I just mean in terms of how they took it, extreme Ahlul Hadith, and again, not using the word extreme in a bad way, and extreme Ahlul Rai. Extreme Ahlul Hadith, we have Dawud al-Zahiri. Al-Zahiri means the literalist. So, people of his time called him Dawud the literalist. Because he took everything in the Quran and Hadith literally. And he rejected qiyas as a source of fiqh. So he's like, we're going to follow the hadith to the word. Right, to such an extent that, for example, the hadith that says that if a woman is asked for her consent in marriage, her silence is her consent. So he said she has to stay silent. She can't say anything. If she says yes, it means no. This is how literally he took the hadith. Right? So this is literalism. Opposite direction, we have the so-called Shia madhab. I don't really regard them as Shia, but most people do. The Zaydis. Right? So Zayd ibn Ali, he's one of the descendants of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He has his own madhab. And by the way, this madhab still exists today. Many people think only four madhabs exist today. The Zaydis still exist in Yemen. This madhab is still followed right till today in Yemen. Right? So, again, those who think only four madhabs existed, wrong. Those people who think only four madhabs exist now, still wrong. Zaydis still exist today. Right? This is a madhab that still exists in Yemen. They went complete Ahlul Ra'i. Meaning, they considered human intellect a source of Islamic law. Now, what's the difference between Qiyas and human intellect? Anyone knows? What's the difference between Qiyas and human intellect? We said Abu Hanifa made Qiyas, but Imam Zayd saying human intellect is the source of law.
Qiyas is analogy.
Based on?
Based on practice before.
Yes, based on Quran and Hadith. Yes. So basically, Qiyas is using your intellect, but you are restricting it to principles taken from Quran and Hadith. While intellect by itself means, you know, whatever the alim thinks is right. So this is the opposite direction. This madhab still exists. Other madhab, Sufyan al-Thawri, Abu Lays, Al-Tabari, Al-Bukhari, all of these ulama at that time had their own fiqh and their own following. Right? So all of these ulama, like Imam al-Bukhari, again a myth, some people say Imam Bukhari followed the Shafi'i madhab. He did not. He made his own fiqh rulings. There are issues where Imam Bukhari had a completely different opinion from all four madhabs. For example, touching the Quran without wudu. All four madhabs say haram. Imam Bukhari said halal. So which madhab is he following? None. He's an independent mujtahid. He's an independent scholar with his own students and his own following. So all of this goes on in the flowering phase. Many madhabs develop. And as you can see, they're developing different understandings of fiqh. Why? Because they have different approaches to fiqh. So, all of these are pious individuals. All of these people, remember, when it comes to differences of opinion amongst the ulama, don't judge a person's piety for it. These are all pious and sincere scholars, they just have different approaches. One takes something literally, one takes it figuratively, but they're all sincerely trying to follow the Quran and Sunnah. And that's why all of the approaches are acceptable. Right, so what happens now? The expansion phase. Now this isn't found in the book that I used, but I added it on my own side. So basically, what happens now is, over the next 300 years, the madhabs start to dwindle. So for example, Abu Lays, his followers don't last much longer because he doesn't have dynamic students. Right? For a madhab to last, it doesn't mean that not only the founder had to be a dynamic celebrity type of personality, but his students as well, and their students as well. It's got to be this generation of scholarship keeping it alive. So Abu Lays, his students weren't as dynamic as him, and within a few generations, his madhab disappears. The Zuhri madhab wasn't practical. It wasn't practical. So therefore, you find throughout history, every few generations, a few Zuhris pop up, but it never really sustained itself the way the other madhabs did. So for example, in late Islamic Spain, they were Zuhiris. Right? In fact, at one point, the rulers of Spain were Zuhiris themselves. But it like comes and goes. Just recently, I met someone on Twitter who identifies as a Zuhiri. Right? So I mean, it's coming back now. Some people want to do this method. But it's not practical because when new issues pop up, if you don't make qiyas, how do you deal with it? Right? So literalism is something that came and went. So now what happens in this era? The ulama of this era, they stop making their own usul. Instead, they pick from the previous scholar's usul. So one alim will say, you know what, I like Abu Hanifa's method, I'll be a Hanafi. Another alim will say, I like Imam Malik's method, I'll be Maliki. Someone else says, I like Dawood's method, I'll be a Zuhiri. Right? So they're choosing their usul based on the scholar whose method makes most sense to them. Right? So this is what's going on in this era. Notice, they are not blindly following their scholar. They are not, for example, someone who becomes a Hanafi in this point in time, as an alim, not talking about the average Muslim, an alim at this time, who is Hanafi, is not following every opinion of Abu Hanifa. Rather, he's using the usul of Abu Hanifa to formulate his own opinions. Right? We see the same with all of the other madhab. So here's an example from each madhab. During the expansion phase, the Hanbali madhab produces Ibn Taymiyyah. Right? Ibn Taymiyyah, a lot of Hanbali fiqh comes from him. And his opinions are very different from Ahmad ibn Hanbal in many issues, but he follows the same usul. The Maliki madhab, we have Ibn Arabi, we have Al-Qurtubi, we have many others. And they differ with Imam Malik on many issues, but they follow his usul. In the Shafi'i madhab, we have Al-Ghazali, Imam Al-Ghazali, Imam An-Nawawi. And they again, they differed with Imam Ash-Shafi'i on many issues. Right? So for example, Imam Ash-Shafi'i believed that music is not permissible. Imam Ghazali believed it is permissible. He's using the same usul, he's using the Shafi'i usul, but he's coming to a different conclusion. Right? The Hanafi madhab, we have At-Tahawi. Right? Abu Ja'far At-Tahawi, who writes the first Aqidah book. So Aqidah was written much later than all the other fields. It only starts to develop in this era. So for example, if you look at At-Tahawi, he was Hanafi. But he would raise his hands before and after ruku. Why? Because using Abu Hanifa's usul and analyzing the hadiths of his time, he came to a different conclusion than Abu Hanifa. But he's still known right to today by all Hanafis as a Hanafi scholar. Right? Which means even within the Hanafi madhab, this opinion exists. And in the Zahiri madhab, we have the most famous of all the scholars, even more famous than Dawud al-Zahiri himself, Ibn Hazm of Spain. Ibn Hazm is one of the most famous scholars in our history. In fiqh, he was the most literalist person you'll ever meet. Right? Like I recently read through his old usul al-fiqh section and I couldn't understand it because it was so literalist. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. He was so, like he spends like 5 to 10 pages just trying to prove that no such thing as qiyas. Yet when you read his ruling, he's making qiyas, he's just not calling it qiyas. Because it's impossible to do fiqh without qiyas. Right? But in other areas, he's a genius. So for example, he has this book that I read recently called The Ring of the Dove. That's the translation. And it's a book he wrote for fun, which is basically a collection of love stories that happened in Spain during his lifetime. And the book should have an age restriction because he gets very descriptive and very, very, let's just say, Muslims at that time weren't as conservative as we are. So an alim at that time had no problem writing a book that was very descriptive of the love stories of his time. And then he got books on philosophy and books on a variety of other subjects. So brilliant, brilliant alim. So now again, we're going through the eras. We had the madhabs develop. Now the madhabs in the next era are what? They are guidelines. Right? This is an important point. They are guidelines. They are the usul. The ulama of this era, they choose this usul, but they are not expected to just follow the scholar in every ruling. So for example, in the Shafi'i madhab, Imam Ash-Shafi'i said that growing a beard is wajib, right? And that shaving the beard is haram. Imam An-Nawawi said it's makruh. Different conclusions in the same madhab, right? So this is happening now.
Sorry, what period was that in terms of centuries?
The century, we're looking now at the 4th, 5th and 6th century. Yeah, right?
300
say about 300 years. That's between, and again, I'm using very broad, obviously like Ibn Taymiyyah came much later, right? And Imam At-Tahawi came much earlier, but I'm just like, we're doing it very broadly today. Moving on from there. Now we come to the part of our history, in any subject, I don't like this part of our history. Whether I'm teaching about science or hadith or anything, the stagnation and decline part of our history. So every nation rises and falls. And this ummah fell twice. Who knows what those two occasions are? When the ummah fell. When it went downhill and then it collapsed. Twice. Mongols and World War One. Mongols and World War One. Mark these two occasions. These two occasions, well, Mongols won, they recovered a century later with the Mamluks and the Ottomans. World War One, we still haven't recovered. We're still at the bottom. Right? So what's happening now happened before. What's happening now with the downfall of the Ummah and the stagnation and decline, it happened at the time of the Mongols. And within 100 years, the Ummah recovered. That's why I believe we can recover again. It is possible, inshallah. Right? So every nation goes up and down. Two major things, the Mongols and World War One. So what happens is that people start to take things for granted. And they stop, they stop making an effort. You can say this happens to every nation, right? We plan is happening to America right now, right? They go up, and then the stagnation and decline begins, and then what happens? Collapse, right? Every nation. So this happened to the Ummah in the Abbasid era. It happened in the Ottoman era. The Abbasid era, they started going down. They start losing power. People stop really taking things seriously. People start falling into more sins. The scholarship starts to decline as well. The quality of the ulama produced starts to decline as well. And before you know it, the Mongols come in Genghis Khan himself saying, Allah is sending me to punish all for your sins. And the people are so sinful, they're believing it, and they're sitting there letting their heads get chopped off because they know what sins they're committing, right? And it looks like Qiyamah. It was so bad that the ulama who lived during this period, they honestly believed that the Mongols were Ya'juj and Ma'juj. They thought this is the end of the world. Ya'juj and Ma'juj broke through the wall of China. They're coming for us, they're killing everyone, the world's going to end, right? But it didn't. And just like that, many Muslims, they think the world's going to end. It could not, only Allah knows. We don't live our life with a world end mentality. So the Mongols happened. And they took thousands of Islamic books and destroyed them. There are many books in our heritage which are extinct. They don't exist anymore because of the Mongol invasion. Right? Very, very important books of fiqh are destroyed completely. We don't know. We don't know anything about these books. Sometimes we know their names. We know them because later scholars said, this book, you know, I got information from it. We can't find that book. Destroyed. World War I again. So what happens? The Ummah rises up after the Mongol invasions with the Mamluks in Egypt, the Ottomans in Turkey. And again, I'm going through this very quickly. Already running out of time. But they rise up again. The Ottomans go through their golden age in the time of Suleiman the Magnificent. And then they start their decline. The Ottoman decline, same thing happens again. Scholarship levels decline, technology declines, culture declines, economics decline. The Ottomans now become like the weak link in Europe. And this is very important. While the Ottoman decline is happening, what's happening in the other parts of the world? The Renaissance, the Industrial Revolution, all of this is going on. So, during our golden age, Europe were, to be blunt, barbarians. Europe was a barbarian land. Right? They looked up to the Muslim civilization. Now, as the Ottoman Empire is going down, what's happening with Europe? They becoming the dominant powers of the world. Right? And then the colonizing of the Muslim lands begin. And it all comes to a head where? World War I. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the division of the Muslim world into many states, and that's where we are today. So what happens in fiqh during this period? They simply stop producing real ulama. Here and there, you'll find one. Here and there. The way I look at it historically, I think out of every generation, you'll find two or three alims who are like really like the alims of the past. But now the ulama are like, they just start following. They basically memorize the books of the elders and teach those books to their students. Memorize, teach. But if you ask them to explain, they can't. Right? Now there is a logical reason for what happens next. What happens next is called the closing of the doors of ijtihad, and it's right till today very controversial. So what happens during this period is a lot of ulama say, we don't need ijtihad anymore. The doors are closed. The question is, did they close it permanently or can we open it again? Right? That's the big problem that causes debates right till today. So why did they close it? I'm trying to put this into perspective for you. Basically, imagine if you will, for like 500 years, nothing important happens. The culture doesn't change. Politics don't change. Technology doesn't change. And whatever's happening happened 500 years before. Wherever people come to ask you, you can find it in the books. So ulama living during that period, they're like, there's nothing left for us to do. We can just teach the books to others. Right? There is nothing new. Because there literally was a period in our history where there was nothing new. You could literally just learn a book, pass it on, and that's all people needed to know. Right? So what you'll find in the books during this period normally focused on explaining the older books. There's nothing left to do. So you'll find, for example, a book of fiqh. Then you'll find explanation of that book of fiqh. Then you'll find explanation of the explanation of that book of fiqh. Then you'll find summary of the explanation of the explanation of that book of fiqh. Then the summary of the summary of the explanation of the explanation, because people are bored. That's all. Honestly, when I study this period, I just think, ulama were bored, they had to write something. Right? So it's going around in circles. And during this time, everything falls apart. This brings us to the final stage. And again, this final stage is not in the book I used, but from my own readings of history, I worked this out. And that's the past 300 years. A lot of people think it's the past 100 years, but the ulama I'm going to mention go back to the 18th and 17th century. Revival. So what happens? Europe is rising. The world is changing. Colonialism. Industrial Revolution. Ulama realize, hold on, we close the doors of ijtihad, we may need that again. They realize, we may need it again. Things are changing. So during this period, three new approaches developed towards fiqh. So we can say in the 300 to 400 years before this, fiqh is now simply follow a madhab, right? But now the British are invading, they're taking over Muslim lands, they have better technology, new things are coming about. What do we say about coffee? What do we say about the printing press? What do we say about all these things? Ijtihad is needed again. Now ulama take four approaches. Approach number one, our forefathers followed the madhab, we're following the madhab. Right, that's approach number one. Approach number two, Shah Waliullah Ad-Dihlawi of India. He says, hold on, we the ulama of the madhabs, we need to reopen the doors of ijtihad. Because new issues are coming up. Who's going to deal with these new issues? The ulama have to make ijtihad again. Right? So he writes entire books about the importance of ijtihad and the goals of the sharia and usulul fiqh, and he tries to motivate the ulama of India to start making ijtihad. Right? Meanwhile, in Yemen, Ash-Shawqani, studying from a Zaydi madhab, he says, oh, no, we don't need these madhabs anymore. This is his approach. He's like, we don't need these madhabs anymore. Let's go directly to Quran and Sunnah. Right, so he calls for abandoning of madhabs and just make ijtihad on your own. Right? Number three. Sorry about that. Let's go back. Right? Number three. In Egypt. Egypt gets colonized. One of the first Muslim countries to get colonized. The ulama in Egypt now, Muhammad Abduh, his student, Rashad Rida, they're like, we have to catch up with the rest of the world. So they're like, we need to open the doors of ijtihad, but we need to interpret Islam in a modern way. This is their mentality. We need to interpret the Islam in the modern way. And this we see the birth of the modernist movement. Right? So now, we have four different approaches. And guess what? This hasn't been solved. Right till today, all four approaches are around. Right till today, you're going to find all four approaches. So this developed about three centuries ago, and it still exists till today. Before I conclude, I just want to mention one quotation from one of my favorite books that beautifully summarizes this history in one paragraph. And I apologize if the writing is a bit small. You can listen to me say it instead. This book is from The Road to Mecca by Muhammad Asad. Muhammad Asad, a famous convert to Islam, he wrote a beautiful autobiography called The Road to Mecca. It's one of my favorite books I've ever read. Like, anyone asks me for a book to read, I give them this book. Beautiful. It's really, really beautiful. But my favorite passage in this entire book, he goes to Al-Azhar University in Egypt and he meets one of the ulama. And this alim tells him the following. Listen to this. He says, and he points to the other ulama, and he says, do you see those scholars over there? They are like sacred cows in India, which I am told, eat up all the paper they find in the streets. Yes. They gobble up all the printed pages from books that have been written centuries ago, but they do not digest them. They no longer think for themselves. They read and repeat, read and repeat. And the students who listen to them learn only to read and repeat, generation after generation. This is the conversation between an alim in Egypt and a convert 50 years ago. Right? So the convert asks him, he says, but Sheikh Mustafa, Al-Azhar is the central seat of Islamic learning, the oldest university in the world. One encounters its name in every page of Muslim cultural history. What about the great thinkers, the theologians, the historians, the philosophers, the mathematicians it produced over the last 10 centuries? Listen to his reply. And again, this conversation summarizes the whole history. He says, they stopped producing them several centuries ago. And he said, perhaps not quite. Here and there, an independent thinker has somehow managed to emerge, even in recent times. And so he's saying, here and there you will find, yes, you will find Ash-Shawqani, Ibn Taymiyyah, Shah Waliullah, independent thinkers emerging here and there. But on the whole, Al-Azhar has lapsed into the sterility from which the whole Muslim world is suffering. Important, I'm not talking and picking on one university, I'm talking about the whole Muslim world. Right? And its old impetus has all but extinguished. Those ancient Islamic thinkers whom you have mentioned would never have dreamt that after so many centuries, their thoughts, instead of being continued and developed, would only be repeated over and over again. We think Abu Hanifa, Ash-Shafi, Imam Malik, they thought people are going to follow their word as if it's the word of God. No, they were academic, intellectual thinkers. And they thought their students and their students and their students would follow in their footsteps. But things changed, right? So he said, you'd think that this would happen, that people would just memorize their thoughts and they repeat it over and over again as if it was ultimate and infallible truths. And that's how people are nowadays. You know, if they read a certain alim said something, they take it as if Allah said it. And this is the problem. He says, if there is to be any change for the better, thinking must be encouraged instead of present thought imitation. This conversation summarizes where we are today. It really summarizes beautifully. And really, if you haven't read this book, please read it. It's a very beautiful story. So that brings us full circle. Where are we today? Where we are today is, we are divided. Simple as that. We are divided into four camps. Number one, the traditionalists. Those are those who say, we have our madhab, we stick to it, we follow it. No ijtihad, nothing. Just follow the madhab. And that's the majority. Number two, we have the non-conformists. These are the ones who say we don't need madhabs. Just make your own ijtihad. Like 300 years ago, Ashokani. Recent century, Albani. Right? Albani, who started the Salafi movement. He's from this camp. The Ahle Hadith movement of India also fall into this camp. Number three, we have the modernists. The modernists say, abandon the madhabs. Change Islam to suit the times. Right? This is their methodology. Islam must suit the times. And this is a dangerous methodology. Very dangerous methodology. I mean, I respect the alims I listed here, Muhammad Abdu and Rashad Rida, great thinkers of their time, but the methodology they started, today, it's out of control. Today it's completely out of control, venturing towards kufr. Nowadays we have modernists saying that homosexuality is halal, and zina is halal, and alcohol is halal. They're just changing everything. I don't think they would have approved of that, but that's the methodology they started and what has led to 200 years later. Right? And finally, we have the reformers. And the reformers, they say, we need the madhabs. Madhabs are important. They give us usul. They make it easy to learn things like salah, wudu. They give the community something to unite behind. But the ulama need to make ijtihad. This is the difference. The reformers say, follow madhab. But the ulama at least need to be intellectuals. They need to be able to solve the problems of their time. They need to make ijtihad. So, Shah Waliyula was the one who started this. He wrote about in Hujjatullah al-Baligha, and many alims after him followed in his footsteps. In the previous century, perhaps the best example of this was the great Maliki scholar Ibn Ashur. Right? He wrote a great book on the goals of the Sharia, and he really revolutionized how we do ijtihad in our times. Nowadays, many ulama fall into this category around the world, even if they don't think they fall into this category. Right? Like Mufti Taqi Usmani. I don't think he considers what he did. I don't think he considers it to be ijtihad. But really, in the field of Islamic economics and Islamic banking, he is the main mujtahid of our times. Right? He's the man who basically revolutionized that field. So this is where we are. We stuck. We are unable to unite on a position to take. And this unity is causing a lot of problems, a lot of infighting, a lot of clashes. Reality is, I don't think this will be solved until one method starts to produce actual results. And then the average person will say, oh, that method's working, let's follow that. Right? For now, we remain stuck. Wherever you go in the Muslim world, you will find traditionalists, you will find nonconformists, you will find modernists, you will find reformers. You will find all four types. Right? My personal position is the last one. Reformation. Which simply means, let people follow their madhabs. Nothing wrong with it. Right? But the ulama that study in these institutes need to become mujtahids at some point. At least some of them, at least the A-plus students should become mujtahids. Right? I mean, someone's passing an alim course with D's and C's, we don't want them making ijtihad. Right? But at least take your most intellectual students and raise them to the level where they can deal with the problems of our time. Because why did they close the doors of ijtihad? Because nothing new was popping up. There's no need for it. Nowadays, every day something new is popping up. Just last week, doctor brought up AI. Right? There's something new. We have to make ijtihad to figure out whether we have to make ijtihad to figure out whether an AI can make ijtihad. Just figuring that out itself is ijtihad. Right? Every day people come up with new things, you know. If I fly to another country and back in one day, am I a musafir? Right? You think the madhabs answer that? Never imagine that. Right? They never imagine that. Right? All kinds of things. We need it today. But we still need the madhabs. Why? Because, you know, from my personal experience, abandoning the madhabs, especially for the average Muslim, it just leads to confusion. It leads to confusion. I mean, how many Muslims have the time to study all the usul al-fiqh and read through Sahih Bukhari and read through all the books of fiqh? Ulama can do that. But the average Muslim should follow, which I think we should go back to the method of the first few generations, which is, ulama should be intellectuals, And if the ulama are intellectuals, then the local people can follow them, and they will actually give them solutions to their problems, rather than just memorizing and passing on. So that's the history, and I hope I didn't come across as too rough or condensating on any of these positions, but I'm very passionate about this topic, because we as a community, to move forward, to be blunt, we need a South African fiqh. Right? We cannot import fiqh from India or Saudi Arabia or somewhere else. We need a South African fiqh. It can be based on the Hanafi usul fiqh, can be based on the Shafi usul fiqh, all of that is fine. But we have to deal with the problems of our land. We have to make fiqh relevant to our land. And for this, we need a new generation of ulama who are trained in this field. And that's going to take a while. Right? That may take an entire generation of two, if you can get moving in that direction. So, JazakAllah khair to all of you for your attention. I know this was a lot to take in 50 minutes. As I said, I normally spend 5 months teaching this. Try to summarize in 50 minutes. I don't know how good job I did in that time. But we open the floor to Q&A now for the next half an hour or so. Again, raise your hands and I'll take questions one this side, one that side. So, any questions or anything from this past history, or any of these things mentioned on the slides, you can raise your hands now and we'll deal with your questions. Yes?
Can you have a copy of the slides?
Sure, Muhammad will organize the copies for you. Alright?
Ibn Rushd wrote Bidayat al-Mujtahid, which is a compendium of all the different madaris.
Yes.
And the fiqh rulings of all of the madaris, which is quite sort of easily accessible to most people.
Yeah.
And it gives you the level of dalil for all the different aspects of it. Wouldn't that be relevant today?
It would be, but not for solving new issues.
No, not for solving new issues.
Talking about for the old age. Yeah, it's possible.
For an example, you the strongest hadith on a particular aspect.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Strongest hadith according to who? Because what you're going to find, if you go deep into hadith, you'll come across a hadith which it's strong according to the Shafi madhab, but not strong enough according to the Hanafi madhab. It's strong according to one scholar, but it's weak according to another scholar. Right? So it gets technical. So it could be strong according to Ibn Rushd, but it might not be strong according to Ibn Hajar. Understand what I'm saying? The sciences can be technical. So these issues are not that easily. So if they were, we'd have just one madhab, to be that simple. You know, a lot of times younger students tell me, teach me the strongest opinion on every issue. And I tell them, if it's that simple, we wouldn't have differences of opinion.
So, the point I'm trying to make is that not only have the doors of Ijtihad been closed, but also the doors of Taqlid.
Yes. So,
but people like Ibn Rushd has opened the door of Taqlid, where you've actually got a choice between the two madhabs.
Okay, but now choosing between madhabs, again, I myself choose between madhabs, right? Just to be clear. I follow Hanafi usul al-fiqh, but I pray Salah and Hanbali method because I found the hadiths to be strong on that issue. But it's very technical. I don't recommend it for everybody because let me give you some of my experience, right? 10 years ago, I spent 2 months in India living in the Ahle Hadith community. And are you familiar with the Ahle Hadith methodology on fiqh? The Ahle Hadith believe that madhabs are a bid'ah, an innovation. This is their methodology. So everybody must just follow Quran and Hadith. So when I was living there, I'd meet people who don't know Arabic, who don't know Usul al-Fiqh. They'll pick up a hadith, they'll read it, and they'll make their own conclusion from the hadith. And their conclusion will be completely wrong. But they are convinced, I'm not following you, you and Ali, I'm following the hadith. Right? And they came up with bizarre rulings. So my point is, this is a field that requires a lot of study. If you want to do that, you need to study Usul al-Fiqh. You need to study Arabic. You need to study Maqas. You need to choose your Usul al-Fiqh first. Are you following Malik's method, Hanafi method, Zahiri method? And then using that, you have to analyze everything. It takes years of study. It's not just, for example, one of the guys I met, right, he told me, Jummah on a Friday is wajib. It's in Sahih Bukhari. And he's right, it's in Sahih Bukhari. Right? In Sahih Bukhari, there's a hadith that says, Ghusl on Jummah is wajib. Right? So, Ghusl on Jummah is wajib. This is in Sahih Bukhari. Is Ghusl on Jummah wajib according to any madhab? Anyone knows? No madhab says that. Even though the hadith is in Sahih Bukhari. Why? Because there's another hadith in other hadith books that abrogates it. Where the Prophet ﷺ says, I used to make your bath on a Friday, but now whoever wants to bath should bath, whoever wants to make wudu should make wudu. So that hadith abrogates the other hadith. How many people know both hadiths exist? You'll have to do an in-depth research to figure it out, right? So that method is good, but with the pre-study to go into it, not just jumping headlong. It's like someone diving into the deep end before learning how to swim. That's why usulul fiqh comes first before we go there. Yes? You have a question? This side, come another question? Okay, doctor.
Coming back to, you spoke about the South African thing.
Yeah.
And given the politics in the Muslim world and the freedom of religion and association and ability to set up in our own Islamic university.
Yeah.
You haven't studied in our local or the methodology in our local arrangements, but to the best of your knowledge, are the processes in by which students are taught in the local arrangements conducive to giving, germinating that seed of trying to develop, I won't even go and say lateral thinking, maybe
yeah,
a bit too far, but just the ability to start looking at things differently.
Okay, so my history of studies, I spent 7 years in a local Darul Uloom. Yeah, I did. I spent 7 years, I graduated as a Molana, and then I went and did a bachelor's in Islamic studies and headed in a different direction. So, I did do that first. So I have done both. And I can compare both systems. And having studied in there, I can tell you straight, the way it's taught in our country, no. It's strictly traditionalist. It is exactly what the other sheikh was saying. You learn the book, you memorize the book, you teach the book. Right? To such an extent that last week I opened up a book I studied when I was 15 years old in the Darul Uloom. And I started reading that book, and I'm like, this is such a brilliant intellectual book. It's a magnificent book. I mean, if studying it now, it's blowing my mind how amazing this book is. But when we learned it in the madrasa, we basically memorized the book and had to repeat it word for word in an oral exam to pass. And not a single student in my class understood it. Not a single student. It was literally just learned for the sake of memorization and passing an exam. And they forgot it as soon as the exam was over. Now going back and rereading it as an adult, I'm like, this is a book that can solve problems of our time. If it is taught in a proper manner, if it's taught to the right people in the right manner. So, we need a new method of teaching. Now, there are Darul Ulooms in the world that do teach in the right method. A good example would be Nadwatul Ulama in India. Right? Their methodology is brilliant. They are training ulama on this level. Honestly, many of the ulama I met who graduated from there are on this level. And that's because their founders are influenced by Shah Wali Ullah. Their founders are influenced by Shah Wali Ullah, right? They are also, for example, in many other countries like that. But it's the exception, not the norm. Right? The norm is that you taught something, you memorize it, you pass it on, you don't question it. And that's problematic because, you see, what's being passed as the madhabs today are fatwas generated in India 300 or 200 years ago. So a fatwa passed in India 200 years ago saying it's haram for a woman to go to school. We have people saying it today. Why? Because it's in the book. Whatever's in the book, you have to follow. Well, that alim passed it for that time, for that culture, in that situation, for a reason. Maybe it made sense then. Colonization was happening, the school was using to brainwash women, so he didn't want the woman going to that school. We're in a different culture, a different time, a different place. We can't just take a fatwa from that book and follow it. Right? We have to rethink it in terms of our time and our place. That's an issue. We, as a community, I think the first step would be to open a whole new series of madrasas or Darul Ulooms, right? Or at least one university that teaches in this manner. Because otherwise we're not going to produce ulama on this level. Right? Either that or get all our ulama to attend this class and try and convince them to change their mind. Any other questions?
How does where the ulama or scholars study and where they are based in around the world affect their thoughts? So, for example, from my limited reading, the Maliki scholars in Spain had more open-minded to like subjects like music and so forth because they were in
Spain, they were in the musical culture.
Maliki scholars in Arabia, and that's the same for the Hanafi in the Ottomans compared to the Hanafi in the subcontinent.
Yeah.
And how does the way with the base affect, and when how does that become limitation?
Okay, so we're going to discuss that in week 5. Week 5 is about urf, local culture, which is a important principle of fiqh in the Hanafi and the Maliki madhab. According to Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Malik, fiqh should be based on the culture you are living in. Right? So this is why you will find, actually Imam Shafi'i, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal also agree on this. They just didn't use a term for it. They didn't use the term urf for it. But they do have this in their madhabs. So for example, even today you see this. The Shafi'i madhab, Imam Ash-Shafi'i was of the opinion that for a woman to cover her face is compulsory. If you go to a Shafi'i country like Malaysia today, nobody covers their face. No one tells him to cover a face. Not a single Shafi'i alim said it's compulsory. Why? Because that fatwa doesn't make sense in their culture. It doesn't make sense in their culture at all. To tell the women of Malaysia to cover their faces would not make sense. They won't understand. What are you telling us to do? I mean, the men lower their gaze. Have you been to their culture? Do you see how men lower their gaze in their community? There's no need for how respectful they are for women. There's no need for that. Ash-Shafi'i lived in a different time and place. He lived in a place where every woman covered her face. For a woman to reveal her face with a problem. Right? So his fatwa was affected by the culture he lived in. The Shafi'is today affected by the culture they live in. Right? It's the same across the globe. Now, there's two ways it affects them. One is like this, where they're actually using the usul. The other is where they take their culture as the religion. And that's when it becomes a problem. So for example, someone goes to Saudi Arabia or to India to study. And then they come back to South Africa and they try to make this place like Saudi Arabia or India. That's a problem. That's a major problem, because now they're essentially trying to enforce a foreign culture upon their lands. Right, so we see this a lot with people who study in Saudi Arabia and then they go to the USA or the UK and they just try to Arabicize everybody. Right, it doesn't work. You have to adapt to the local culture. So this is the principle. We'll cover it in details in week 5. And the maxim is al-adat muhakkama. Local culture is the deciding factor. Which means, according to all four madhabs, when there is a clash of cultures and none of it is haram, that's the key point, none of it is haram, you go with the local culture, right? Meaning, someone saying wear kurta, someone else is saying wear shirt and pants. So long as your shirt and pants are not violating the condition of the Sharia, which is covering from your navel to knees modestly, wear shirt and pants. It's local culture, right? So this is where the principle comes in. We will spend an entire hour just discussing it, all the ins and outs of it, how it works, what's the restrictions, all of that, inshallah.
My follow-up question to that would be, so there's an opinion that because the Maliki madhab was based in the westernmost country at the time, Spain, and had interaction with Europeans, mm-hmm. and due to the fact that Europe colonized a lot of the world,
yeah.
There's a movement back towards the Maliki madhab because it incorporates a lot of Western culture and makes it easier for people living mm-hmm. in the West
I've seen that happening in America, not here, but in America. It makes sense here. It makes sense for people in America to follow. But again, remember, fiqh is going to differ from place to place. So if someone's in America, I would actually tell them Maliki madhab may be better for you. But in South Africa, we have to face reality. Hanafi madhab is dominant here. Did the Hanafi usul allow us to do the same thing? Because urf is part of the Hanafi usul of fiqh. Right? So we can use the Hanafi usul, still be Hanafi, and come up with those same fatwas. Right? Because it doesn't go against our usul of fiqh. So there's no need for us to change our madhab completely. You know, say, okay, you know what? The guys in this class will be the first Malikis of South Africa. Right? And let's relearn fiqh from beginning. Let's learn Maliki Salah, Maliki Wudu, Maliki everything. Just stick with what we've got. And let's go forward this way, that we'll use our usul to reform these issues. Right? Like, you gave a very good example, the issue of music. Music in the Hanafi madhab. Did the Turkish Hanafis have a problem with it? No. Did the Indian Hanafis have a problem with it? Some yes, some no. Why? Their cultures. Right? In the Turkish culture, music is such a norm that even the Hanafi ulama had no problem with it. Right? Because culture affected their madhab in that way. And this is, again, many people, they think the madhab is just what Abu Hanifa said. It's not. It's 1,000 years of scholarship evolving in different parts of the world, affected by the local culture, affected by the local things. And so you can't just take it as if it's the word of Allah. It is the words of people. Right? So, yeah, we will talk about culture later, inshallah, another day. Any more questions? Yes, Professor?
There's maybe no time to discuss this. Just some comments. First of all, someone that we came, I think, last year,
mm-hmm.
remember, he was there at Tarawih Sun. And basically, what I was saying that the Tarasin's army syllabus or curriculum must be put aside because it's too much of emphasis on ibadah, mm-hmm. very little on muamalah.
Right.
What he was saying is that today's time, there should be greater emphasis on muamalah and less So that's what it is.
Okay.
Right. Second one is, you know, the other hadith, you know, we have, okay, I won't mention the name, we have families in South Africa, we don't have other hadith.
Mm.
But they not simply disagree with opinion, they actually swear, literally swear the Imams.
Yeah, I met them as well. Right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah,
and the third one is the Muslim personal law, you know, the bill that was drafted by Moran Mujahid al-Islam when he came to South Africa, Sheikh Umar, is based on all four of that. And a lot of it is based on the Maliki.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not practical today to actually implement Muslim personal law based only on one.
Okay.
So this is my
point. Yeah, so again, the 3 points, hope I remember all three. First point I forgot already. Yeah, I forgot the first point already. Your first point was about?
The
curriculum, it's a good point, yeah. I forget that one. Okay, so he's saying that our curriculum locally focuses on acts of worship. Arabic word is ibadat, not on our worldly dealings, the mu'amalat, right? So in fiqh, we have two categories. The ibadat, that's salah, zakah, fasting, hajj, jihad, this is called the ibadah, acts of worship. On the other side, you have the mu'amalat, marriage, divorce, business, all of this. Now, our local curriculum, we teach people salah, zakah, hajj, all of that. How many of us actually learn the fiqh of business? Nobody. Not even our ulama learn the fiqh of business, you can say honestly. Many of our ulama don't know the fiqh of business.
And Imam Hanifa was very strong.
Imam Hanifa was a businessman. He was a wealthy businessman, right? So, we have to adjust our curriculum accordingly. I believe this is I actually came up with a curriculum recently. I was developing my own curriculum and I realized for high school. Primary school, my opinion is this. Primary school, we teach ibadat. We teach them salah, zakah, all of that. High school, we teach them fiqh of marriage, fiqh of divorce, rights of the spouse, fiqh of business, fiqh of employers, fiqh of employees. Teach them all of that. So when they graduate high school, they know how to live life. Right? This is something we need to do. This has to change. So you're right about that. Right? The other point you mentioned, they're taking from the Maliki Mazhab for certain laws because it's more convenient. Again, across the Mazhab, the ulama can say, okay, on this issue, this Mazhab is stronger, let's go with it. And we have seen that. Like we said, the issue of covering the face. Shafi Mazhab, very clear, woman must cover their face. But today the Shafi ulama followed the Hanafi Mazhab on that. What did the Hanafi Mazhab say? Women don't have to cover their face. But they took that from the Hanafi Mazhab because it's more suitable to our times. Right? So we can do it the opposite way as well. In fact, another thing people take from the Hanafi Mazhab is Mufti Taqi Usmani's fatawa on Islamic banking. Right? That's based on Hanafi usul al-fiqh. But nowadays, all the Mazhab follow his fatwas. Even Maliki, Shafi, they all follow what Mufti Taqi Usmani says on that issue because it makes sense. What he says makes sense and he is very strong in his opinion and he gives proper dalail and all of that. So we can borrow across Mazhabs like that based on evidence and need, but only when the proper usul fit in, not based on desire. It mustn't be based on, you know, I like this fatwa. It mustn't be like, oh, yeah, the fatwa that music is halal, I like it, so I'm going to follow it. Fatwa that don't have to dress in a certain way, I like it, so I'm going to. If you're following it based on what you like, you're not following the fatwa. You're following your nafs. Understand? It must be based on what makes sense according to the usul al-fiqh. That's what we have to go with. That when I use the usul al-fiqh, what conclusion do I come to? Right? So that's what we have to keep in mind because many people nowadays, this is where the modernist camp comes in, they move towards what I like. Right? They will find a way to twist it to go towards what they like. And that's a problem. Right? Otherwise, in of itself, it's not a problem. In fact, we need cross madhab discussions on every issue. And there are councils that do that in Saudi Arabia, in the UK, in USA. Ulama from all the different madhabs get together once a year. They discuss issues. They discuss from all the different perspectives. And at the end of the day, they all follow one united fatwa sometimes, if they end up agreeing, even if it comes from a different madhab. Right? So that does happen. Just, I think we need it more over here. But in other countries, it is happening.
One of the problems we have in the history is that the compilation of a hadith only took place almost in the latter part of the 2nd and 3rd centuries.
Yeah.
Whereas the Mazhabs preceded.
That's true.
Malik, Shafi, Hanbali and Hanafi and Hanafi preceded Bukhari, Muslim, Tirmidhi and others in the compilation.
Yeah, that's true.
So historically, there's a big gap, I think, in terms of the compilation of hadith Can you imagine them quoting hadiths 250 years after the death of the Prophet?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent those hadiths were actually sahih?
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, is the biggest...
That's the doubt people have.
Yes.
Okay.
So the result that what I'm asking, my question I'm asking now is that, let's say the Hanafi fiqh,
yeah,
which started this 140, 150 years, whatever it was, right? Malik was about 90?
Yeah,
yes, 90 years, right? Malik was about 90, mm-hmm, and then came the others. The point is, to what extent did the fiqh of Hanifa, Malik, whoever it is, interrogate the hadith in Bukhari, Muslim, and the Siddha Sahih, for example,
mm-hmm,
and revise the fatwa based on that? Because,
yeah,
it's just amazing, to see the collection of hadith coming so much later.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading a lot of other things right now in one book on fiqh as well. And I can just see all the different contradictory hadith.
Yeah. So, hadith, again, this is a whole separate subject. We will do it, right? Just for those of you who want a quick answer on the spot in terms of something to read, read Jonathan Brown's book on Hadith in the Medieval and Modern World, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World. I'm actually reading it at the moment again. He discusses all of this, he clears all these doubts up, and he explains all the controversies over Hadith very clearly. So basically what he's asking is that fiqh books came first, then came Hadith books, right? Second century, we have Imam Shafi, Imam Malik writing their books. Third century, we have Imam Bukhari, Imam Muslim writing their books. So this makes some people doubt Hadith, that's number one. The authenticity of hadith. Number two, it makes others doubt whether the madhab is actually based on hadith or based on something else, right? So we have two opposite doubts to deal with. Okay, but those who doubt the hadith, the thing is, these ulama were following hadith. It's just that they didn't have access to as many hadith as we have, right? So Imam Malik's Muwatta is full of hadith. There are hundreds of hadith in there, right? That is the earliest hadith book to reach. The biggest hadith book to reach us is by who? Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal. Ahmad ibn Hanbal's hadith book has over 24,000 hadith or something like that. That's before Bukhari and Muslim, right? Of course, it has weak hadith as well, because we said he took weak hadith in fiqh, right? So the point is, hadith did exist at that time, and hadith books did exist at that time. It's just that the history of hadith also went through stages. So we had the compilation phase, then we had the authentication phase, then we had the peak. You say Bukhari and Muslim were the peak of writing hadith. But there were collections in the generation before that, there were collections in the generation before that. They just were still working out, For example, Imam Ahmad said, okay, let's find all the hadith I found and put them all together in a book. And then he showed Imam Bukhari, like, okay, let's go through this and see what's authentic and what's not. So it's a process, it took a few years. Now what happened when later scholars found hadith contradicting their madhab? Easiest example, Hanafi madhab, you can't combine your salah when traveling. The hadith on that is very clear in Sahih Bukhari. The Prophet ﷺ and the Sahaba combined the salah when traveling, right? That's why we have later Hanafis like Abu Ja'far al-Tahawi, Shah Waliullah, not following the madhab on these issues. They don't. They're like, Imam Hanifa was wrong on this issue. There's nothing wrong with saying a human being was wrong on an issue, no matter how much we love him and respect him, right? So, the issue of reconciling the madhabs with the hadith, every madhab has scholars who did that. In the Maliki Mazhab, we had the scholars who did that. In the Shafi Mazhab, I'm trying to remember some of the names. Imam Nawawi was the one who did it for the Shafi Mazhab, right? We see it in his commentary on Sahih Muslim and his Kitabul Majmu'. That's basically what he does. He reconciles hadith from the later books with the Shafi Mazhab, and he changes some of the positions of the Mazhab accordingly. Ibn Taymiyyah did that with the Hanbali Mazhab, right? So there are scholars who did end up doing that as well. So that's my quick answer. Again, inshallah, we will do full course on that. In fact, next week, our topic is Quran and Hadith. Right? So we will discuss a bit more about Hadith in fiqh next week. One more point. Remember your second point now. Forgot to address it. Some of the Ahl Hadith swear the Imams. Right? So when I was in India, the last time I was in India, I went to one city and my friends told me, be careful, there's a group of people here. And they're very extreme. So I said, what do you mean by extreme? So the people came to meet me and they're like, what do you think of Abu Hanifa? I said, mashallah, it's a good Imam of fiqh. You are kafir. This is exactly what he said. Anyone who respects Abu Hanifa is a kafir. This is his words. Hope no one took that as a recording and cut my voice out saying that. But this is the extreme that I found in India. Right? And that pushed me away from that way of thinking, because people in that line are taking it very extreme. How do we deal with that? Firstly, no Muslim in the past 1,400 years had bad thoughts about these four Imams. All of them, even those who didn't follow a mazhab like Albani and Ashokani, they loved and respected all the imams. Right? They just felt themselves on the same level as the imams in terms of being able to make ijtihad. But nobody in our 1,400 year history had a problem with the imams themselves. Right? So now for people to come and start swearing the imams and talking bad about the imams, this is a new, this is a bid'ah. You can say this is a bid'ah. For someone to swear the imams and to say that you believe in imams, you know, or for those who say that madhabs are bid'ah, they are making bid'ah by saying that. Because madhabs are a natural thing. It's just what's going to happen when people get together and discuss fiqh. They're going to form a madhab. I guarantee you, if ulama today abandon the madhabs, start making their own ijtihad, start making their own usul of fiqh, they will end up with new madhabs. And their opinions will be very similar to these madhabs. Right? So, it's just a matter of people coming from strange backgrounds and saying strange things. Honestly, how to deal with that group? I think you need to teach them this history. History may soften them up, but you realize, okay, these were great people and there's actually a natural order of what took place here. It's not just something somebody invented. I think that's an extreme reaction to blind following too. You notice whenever people go on one extreme, the reaction is always opposite extreme. So when people start saying you must follow Abu Hanifa and everything, the opposite extreme was, whoever follows Abu Hanifa is not a Muslim. Right? People like jumping between extremes. And Islam is always the middle part. Right? So that's the part I've chosen. I decide we'll go through here, inshallah.
One more question.
No, I think we've got two more questions.
Two more.
Most of the fiqh and most of the madhais originated in countries where Muslims were in a majority. Mm-hmm. Now there's a sizable portion of Muslims living as minorities
yeah.
in different parts of the world. How much of work has been done on the fiqh of minorities?
Okay.
Because, you know, our challenges are vastly different.
That's true.
Than from the times that originated in Muslim majority countries.
That's true. That's true. Good question. So his question is, the madhabs originated in Muslim majority countries. We're living in Muslim minorities. What's being done about that? Two things. Number one, brother, we have mentioned earlier, the Maliki madhab developed in Spain, where the Muslims were the minority. Right, so that's why in America and stuff, a lot of people are adopting Maliki fiqh because it was adapted in a Muslim minority country and it's actually very suitable for practicing in places like America and things like that. For example, in the Maliki Mazhab, the later Maliki Mazhab, the early Maliki Mazhab, it was different, but with the later Maliki Mazhab, that which developed in Spain, they had no problem with music, right? Because music was part of the Spanish culture. And you will find later Maliki scholars saying it's halal, right? And we find Malikis in America saying the same thing today. Right, so that's one point. The other point is, what's being done about it now? Well, that's really what we want to do here. In America, in the UK, they have their own councils, where they get together and they discuss the fiqh of minority, and they find solutions, and they work it out. We're not doing that in South Africa. That's our problem in our country only. The other countries are doing that. For example, they have committees where ulama from all the madhabs get together, and they discuss, what do we do about insurance? Is there a way to allow it? Right? What do we do about stocks and bonds and what do we do about the fact that in this country you can't own this without insurance, you can't own that without insurance? How do we resolve this? And they discuss it for hours and they come to a practical fatwa. So this is being done in the USA, this is being done in the UK, it's just a matter that we need to start it in South Africa. Right? So people are working on that in other countries. Inshallah we can copy them and do something similar here.
I'm just going to go back to development. How do you build the gravitas? Let me give you a simple example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, you mentioned that Usmani, because that field of economics and Sharia banking hadn't been developed.
Yeah.
So he did everything, as you mentioned, and he built up the gravitas and the reputation
yeah.
to be followed. Around the Cape of Court, those who signed it, there was a whole backlash against even saying, let's talk to the Shia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it carried on until that Marana came from India at Orient, forget his name now.
Jamil.
Tariq Jamil.
Yeah.
So until Tariq Jamil came and said in the lecture, you know, there must be peace between Shias, the same people who were prepared to lynch the silence of the Cape of God and something similar were suddenly silenced. So obviously he had that gravitas.
Yeah.
How do you build that around the modern issues?
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to originate in South Africa, for example, what lineage do you have to come through in the Darul Ulooms? You know, to build up that. I mean, let's say something similar. Look, I went to the Yusuf Patel was there for a few hours. The South African Ulama conference.
Yeah.
Over 3 days, so I attended all 3 days. Right? And some all the from the Diobandis was all the big leaders from all over the country. Right. But a simple thing. like talking about politics in the masjid, let alone standing as an alim, getting involved in politics. They were reverting, as you mentioned, to someone what something had said someone in India
in the colonial
period, right? And that guy said that, and that is like, that has to be the basis on which we even discuss this going forward. So I'm saying, how do you, what gravitas do you have to have or lineage to build up that Taqi Usmani type of thing that you can eventually say, yes, you know what, it is right to be able to talk politics, given the exact future of where our country is heading, for example, how do you get, how do you build it up?
Okay, that's a question I thought about for many years. Right? How do you build up to that level where people take you seriously and actually follow you? Or do you build somebody up in our community that people take seriously and follow in this area? A couple of points that come to my mind about it, because I spent many years thinking about it. I still don't have a, I still don't have an explicit answer, but just a few points that come to my mind about it. Number one, I believe that change comes naturally and gradually, right? Meaning, if some people are doing this work, first you'll get 10 people listening to them, then those 10 people will tell their friends, and then they'll tell their friends, and over 10 or 20 or 30 years, that person builds their following. It's a very slow, natural thing. The second thing is that, you know, you said that Mufti Taqi Usmani has this. Well, he didn't always have this. When I was studying, in the same school of thought that he's called the leader of today, when I was reading the 500 most influential Muslims in the world book, number one for 2020 is Mufti Taqi Usmani, and he's listed as the leader of the Deobandi movement. When I was studying in the Deobandi Institute, our teachers told us, don't listen to Taqi Usmani, he's secretly a Salafi. That's what they used to tell us. 20 years later, he's the leader of the movement. Why? He stuck to his guns. He said, this is my position, this is what I believe, here's the evidence, prove me wrong. And over time, over 20 years, people grew to respect him. Right? And now he is who he is in his community. So, people need to take a stand, people need to prove what they believe in, and you need to work slowly from the ground up. Change comes from the ground up. What happened is like, what will happen is that if somebody is doing this work, they will start off with a few students, then those students will grow in number, and their students may teach other students, and within 100 years, things will change. Now, by the way, as a history student, I can tell you, anytime I found change like this in our history, it took 100 to 200 years. Not something that happens in our lifetime. It's not something that today we come up with an idea and tomorrow suddenly the whole country has changed. Change is slow and gradual, yes?
Just building on that also, I have to say that, alhamdulillah, I enjoyed this, but I'm quite disappointed that at 35 years old, I'm one of the youngest in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for that change to come about, we need more young people to come about. And a lot of forum members here, you guys were in your 30s, 20s when you started this. So, and I know you've tried. I know you've tried to build that same momentum that you guys had that time ago with the youth. But maybe we're not finding that fire. So, if we find those ideas, please share it with us so we can.
Yeah. No, this is my biggest concern every time I come to teach anywhere, is I look around and I hope you see people in their 20s, right? So all my uncles here with the gray hair, I love you all, but when I see your faces, I get disappointed because I'm like, why is his son not here or his grandson not here? Why isn't, where's the next generation? Right? Because what's going to happen? We're losing the next generation. We're not losing them to all to traditionalists or to non-conformists. We're losing them to atheism. We're losing them to kufr, right? And if we can't get them in here to teach them, we're going to lose them completely. So we have to work out some strategy to get them here. For say you're grounded, you know, punishment, you come here for one lesson, and maybe they fall in love with that one lesson and they stick for the rest of their lives. I know what it is, but we've got to get the guys in here somewhere. Tell the guys girls are here or something, whatever it is, just get people to sit for one lesson.
Sorry, Ibrahim.
Yes.
You touched upon the issue of Shia,
yeah,
and how would that relate to the big side of things?
So the Shia also have their own madhabs. Like how we have the people of opinion and people of hadith, they also have the same thing. They have the usulis and the akhbaris. So the usulis are like their people of opinion in fiqh, and the akhbaris are their people of hadith in fiqh, who follow the hadith of the imams. So they also have different madhabs with the same differences, the same problems, the same four categories today. That today you'll have Shias who are traditionalists, Shias who are modernists, Shias who are reformers. The same history is happening parallel in their communities, it's happening in our community. It's just that they have different madhabs and different usul al-fiqh. But literally the same history is happening parallel in their community.
But they've kept the doors of ijtihad open
all the time.
Or they've never closed the doors of ijtihad in their madhabs.
Maybe, yeah. Open. Yeah, that's true.
If we examine all the various scholars, I mean the imams that have developed different madhabs, fundamentally, in terms of the fundamental principles of aqaid and things like that, there isn't much of a difference.
No, not in beliefs.
It's only in ancillary.
It's only in this, what we call this, what I told last week, fiqh is a person's interpretation of Islamic law. That's where they differ, in how they interpreted and worked out Islamic law. As far as belief in the six pillars of Iman and the five pillars of Islam, that's consensus. You know, that's an area where you're not going to find differences between these. It's just a matter of how do we do it. That's where you find the difference. And that's why I say these are not important differences often.
Examines the time Prophet himself, how he taught the Sahaba immediately around him.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very balanced approach.
Yeah.
This is my reading. I mean, I may be wrong. He had a very balanced approach, very pragmatic approach. And the academics that some of the scholars went through in terms of developing the sciences, these are very important and good beacon kind of treasures for the Muslim community.
Mm-hmm.
But the Prophet had a much more balanced approach. He wasn't extremely pedantic about issues to the extent that I'm not talking about the imams, but the students of the imams.
Yeah.
And have we not got lost?
That's true, we
as
have.
As a result of that. And therefore, to transcend from one and take the best out of it, we have a balanced approach and take the best from each scholar, because each scholar in his own right had developed a science. And if you find something that makes logical sense, for example, combining the salah. Any other, like when you're going for Hajj, at times I think to follow the Shafi Mazhab is easier. So the fundamentals are there, and if one examines all the prophets, how did they teach their communities? I think when we get the academic aspects are very, very good. They're very good beacons for us, and they're treasures to us. But if you look at ordinary people like myself, what is important is we must be able to practice Islam in an easy way. And Islam is easy.
And here's the thing.
It's practical.
Whatever you said, I agree most of it. But there's the thing. What is the job of an alim in fiqh? What do you think is the job of an alim? What do you think Abu Hanifa and them define the job of the alim as being? To solve people's problem and make Islam practical for the people. When Imam Abu Hanifa became involved in this field, he did it for two reasons. He wanted to solve people's problems and he wanted to make life easier for them. He didn't do it like how we do nowadays, where we're literally doing the opposite. Right? We're taking his opinions as if it's the word of Allah. No. Alim's job is, listen, they see my community, they see their problems, how can I solve it? How can I find a balanced middle path for them? So, again, the problem comes down to creating a new generation of ulama who actually do that. Right? Until then, people have to probably follow ulama from other countries, they can't find someone in their community who does this. Right? But the point about just going to the madhabs and taking without the usul al-fiqh is very hard to do. Because, as I said, sometimes you may read a hadith in one way, but you're not aware of another hadith that abrogates it. Or not, like the Prophet may have said something in the beginning part of his life and something else in the later part of his life. You're reading what he said in the beginning of his life and you're not aware of what he said later on in his life. Or how the Sahaba understood it. Right? So that's why usul al-fiqh is important. It gives us that balance. And next week we will discuss that. Next week, I'm going to show you how each of the madhabs approach hadith. And also, like for example, the madhabs did not consider every hadith to be revelation. They did not. They broke it down. Certain things the Prophet ﷺ said is revelation. Certain things were culture. Certain things were his personal opinions. Certain things were just a fatwa for an individual. Now, who's going to break that down? Ulama have to do that. Ibn Ashur did an excellent job of that. In fact, I'll go through his division next week. He broke it down into 12 types of hadith. We'll go to that next week. And then you'll see just what a deep field this is and why we have to have proper usul al-fiqh to do it. But that should be good. Inshallah, time's up now.
In the context in which
that's good. Yeah, inshallah. We'll cover all of that next week. Inshallah.